In July of 1965, NASA's Mariner 4 completed the first successful flyby and returned 21 pictures of the red planet back to Earth. It was a technological feat, absolutely amazing.
We're about to encounter the planet Mars with a spacecraft built here at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
But let's face it, what the pictures showed was a bit of a letdown.
The Mariner 4 pictures neither demonstrate nor preclude the possible existence of life on Mars.
No forests, no flowing rivers, not even some humble moss.
Frozen, irradiated, arid, rarefied desert.
I'm Mike and Scott, host of The Pulse, and I was talking with Jordan Bim. He is a historian of science, technology, and medicine. And he says this moment, the pictures and what they revealed, brought the field of Mars exploration to a new challenge. How could scientists keep the funding flowing?
They had to basically fight to continue to send missions to Mars in the face of these sort of disappointing images.
What was their selling point? You know, so we're looking at these images, looks like, you know, just dirt or doesn't look wildly exciting. So how did they sell this continued exploration?
So this is exactly what the focus of my next book is about. And what's really interesting is that community of scientists sort of goes by the name of exobiology, which stood for extraterrestrial biology. And these were academic molecular biologists and astronomers, mostly from academia, who then got funding from NASA. And one of the tools that they used was called a Mars jar. And this was essentially a small simulation of the surface conditions of Mars that you could replicate inside a jar. So low pressure, low temperature, different atmospheric gas mixture, and then they would try and grow things inside there using terrestrial life forms like microbes, mosses, and lichens. And what they found is that some things actually could survive in there. And so even when the images of Mars returned these sort of disappointing pictures, these exobiologists pointed to their Mars jars with things growing inside and said, look, the microbes could still exist in Martian conditions. We need to go not fly by, not orbit Mars, but go down to the surface and look with a microbiology laboratory to see if anything is there. And what's really interesting and what the focus of my book is about is that these Mars jars weren't invented by this community, but they were in fact invented by a lesser known military astrobiology program in the 1950s that has been forgotten. So that's sort of my hook for my new book project.
And why did the military make those Mars jars?
They were not interested in these sort of big questions that animate current astrobiologists like the exobiology community that I mentioned before. Those people, like Carl Sagan, for example, who is one of those exobiologists at NASA, they wanted to know, you know, what is the origin of life? Are we alone in the universe? These sort of big questions. The military scientists who were working for the U.S. Air Force in the 1950s predictably were not interested in questions like that. They wanted to establish an extraterrestrial base on Mars for the United States Air Force that was part of this sort of militarization of outer space that started in the 1950s, animated by the Cold War competition with the Soviet Union.
Wow. So they were going to set up shop up there.
That was the plan. Yeah, there were plans to build a base on the moon. And these Mars jars were part of a plan for a base on Mars. And they wanted to see if there's life on Mars. Could that life be used by us to fuel this extraterrestrial base? And I argue that that's a very instrumentalist, very sort of inhumane relationship with extraterrestrial life that these Mars jars create. And the fact that the exobiology community started using those Mars jars without kind of confronting their military origin means that we still train astrobiologists to have this sort of particular view of extraterrestrial life, which, you know, has these sort of military implications or the sort of militaristic gaze of any sort of microbe as something that we should use rather than something we should maybe leave alone and let have its own planet.
And those jars, I'm picturing kind of like ball jars. What did they look like?
They looked like large pickle jars. And
oh.
Yeah. And they oftentimes were pictured sort of with frost on them because they would have to go in the freezer overnight to simulate the low, low, low temperatures on the surface of Mars.
Oh, so could I make one? Could I have one of those?
You sure could. And what's really interesting is that Carl Sagan became this sort of ambassador for the Mars jar technology in the 1960s and 70s without mentioning their military origin or the military scientist who invented them, who was one of those German scientists who came over in Operation Paperclip, who has a very ethically dubious past, connections to concentration experiments on concentration camp prisoners and that sort of thing. You know, we think of Wernher von Braun as sort of the face of Operation Paperclip and those German scientists who came over. But what my work does and my major focus as a historian of the human and biological problems of space exploration is to tell the story of the life scientists that came over from Germany and how they sort of populated the life sciences of space and created not only the astronaut, but the first astrobiology program, the first biological studies of life on Mars that are now forgotten because, of course, Carl Sagan and the academic scientists came on the scene and reinvented the field and consciously cut ties to those people because they wanted nothing to do with those military Nazi guys.
We come, after all, from hunter-gatherers, and for 99.9% of our tenure on Earth, we've been wanderers. And the next place to wander to is Mars.
So Carl Sagan took the Mars jar, didn't mention who really invented it, Hubertus Strughold, and popularized it to the American public in both his, you know, articles for National Geographic, in his book Cosmos, and his TV series. And the Mars jar became, you know, this sort of popular artifact of astrobiology. You know, students started making them in class at schools. They became a way to train astrobiologists in universities. So people did start making them as like a kind of a fad. They became a thing to do. So you could definitely make one for sure.
Now, Strughold, he was affiliated with the Nazi Party in Germany, then was brought over here because he was a valuable scientist, I guess. And then what happened to him?
So he was never a member of the Nazi Party, unlike Wernher von Braun, who was a member of the Nazi Party and an SS officer. But what Strughold was is he was the head of the Luftwaffe's Aviation Medicine Research Institute in Berlin. And he held that position for 10 years from 1935 to 1945. And you do not hold a high-profile military research position like that unless you are in lockstep with the Nazi ideology and leadership. Like, that just is obvious. And it was under his leadership that members of the Aviation Medicine community in Germany committed some heinous, heinous lethal experiments on concentration camp prisoners at Dachau concentration camp. But despite these connections, Hubertus Strughold was brought to America, was hired by the U.S. Air Force, and in 1949, he was put in charge of the U.S. Air Force's first ever Department of Space Medicine. And this was a very forward-looking research unit at an Air Force base in Texas called Randolph Air Force Base. And, you know, this was over 10 years before NASA was founded that he and another a group of three other German scientists who were also brought over in Operation Paperclip started to work on solving the biological problems of spaceflight for the U.S. Air Force. I think in 1950 is the first time that there's evidence that Strughold started to work on the problem of life on Mars, which he saw as sort of an extension of space medicine. You know, he imagined these Air Force astronauts going to Mars. He wanted to know what kind of life might they encounter there and how could that life be used to establish a military base. That was part of this sort of grand vision of American involvement in space that Wernher von Braun was selling in Collier's Magazine and through those Disney shows that everyone, I'm sure, is familiar with.
To help show you what is being done to solve these problems, we have called upon one of the foremost exponents of space travel, Dr. Wernher von Braun, who is at present the chief of the Guided Missile Division of the Army's Rocket Center at Redstone Arsenal. He was also overall director of the development of the original V-2 rocket.
Now, here's a model of my design for a four-stage orbital rocket ship. Compared to the unmanned instrument rocket, it is quite large. But the overall size...
Was he ever confronted with his past during his lifetime, or did that bubble up later on?
It bubbled up later on. So Hubertus Strughold died in 1986. He retired from the Air Force in 1968. There were periodic investigations by the U.S. Department of Justice into what he had done, but they never came to any charges. But then in the 1990s, investigative reporters uncovered basically incontrovertible evidence that he had knowledge of these lethal human experiments on Dachau concentration camp prisoners in the name of aviation medicine for the Luftwaffe as early as 1942 and did nothing to stop them. He was essentially aware that they were happening and didn't stop them, even though he was the director of the major Aviation Medicine Research Institute. There were also other unethical experiments performed on epileptic children at his institute as well. So it's one of those complicated cases where he was never the one, you know, pressing the button on the pressure chamber to execute a prisoner, but he was connected very closely to people who were and was in a position of oversight and leadership. Even though during the 50s and 60s, he was sort of presented to Americans as this great man of science and was called the father of space medicine, he had awards named after him here. He had a library named after him at Brooks Air Force Base. After those revelations came out in the 90s, slowly there was this canceling of Strughold, which is very reminiscent of what we're going through, you know, right now with the tearing down of a number of Confederate statues, the renaming of buildings who are named after problematic people. This happened to Strughold in the 1990s. And what's interesting is that this was sort of a problem for the field of space medicine. The field of astrobiology never had to really tangle with him because Sagan and those NASA exobiologists had so successfully kind of cut off that secret beginning of astrobiology in the military back in the 1960s. And that's what my work is trying to recover, is to say you must confront this military origin astrobiology because it's influencing how you interact with Mars and how we think about what we might do with extraterrestrial life if we find it today.
Yeah. So the Mars jar is not innocent.
It's not a neutral tool. Exactly. You nailed it. I mean, I really hope that we figure out a way to go to Mars and explore Mars in a way that is more ethical and sort of more thoughtful than the ways we've been doing it in the past. And what I see right now is a rush to Mars. And what I hope is that cooler heads prevail and we, you know, we don't stop, we don't turn away from Mars, but we have a moment of deep introspection, and we see this as a chance, not only to not repeat the mistakes of the past and sort of go to Mars in a sort of a colonialist mindset, but as a chance to actually go to Mars in a better way, a more just way, a more ethical way, to investigate and determine if there was life there, if there could be life there, and then decide what could be done with it in a way that's not just, finders keepers and might makes right and sort of manifest destiny. I really hope that we learn that people who sell these plans for Mars and describe them as logical or natural or inevitable or stuff like that, I really hope that we are able to see those for what they are, which is, a very specific choice that's being disguised as sort of a natural, inevitable thing.
Jordan Bim is a research fellow at the Stefanovich Institute on the Formation of Knowledge at the University of Chicago and Guggenheim Fellow at the National Air and Space Museum. I'm Maiken Scott. Make sure you check out our episodes every week. You can subscribe to The Pulse wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.